Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Wednesday, April 27, 2022. The time is 1:37 in the afternoon. Sorry for the delayed start. We're meeting in Capitol Room number 205. Senators currently in attendance are Senator Keel and Senator Myers and myself as Chair, Senator Holland. I do believe Senator Schauer and Senator Hughes will be able to join us shortly, but we do have a quorum to conduct business. I will remind everyone, if you have your cell phones on board, to please silence your cell phones. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Kelsey, our moderator for today. And today we will start with a hearing. We'll start the hearing with consideration of Richard, and I know I'm going to pronounce this wrong because there's like four different ways to pronounce it, but Mr. Richard Ole Larson. Thank you for the correction. So today we'll start the hearing with consideration of Richard Ole Larson being considered for the State Board of Parole. Mr. Larson, if you would, please state your name, any affiliation, and your location for the record.
And my name is Richard Ole Larson, better known as Ole Larson. I'm affiliated with actually nobody. I'm calling in from Wasilla.
All right. Well, thank you. You're being considered for the State Board of Parole. Do you have any prepared remarks for the committee?
Yes, I do.
If you please.
Like I said, my name is Ole Larson. I graduated from the University of Nebraska at Omaha with a bachelor's degree in science. I obtained a secondary teaching certification from the University of Alaska at Anchorage. I started my career in the Department of Corrections as a youth counselor, working with juveniles at McLaughlin Youth Center in 1976, where I worked with on the boys detention unit as well as the closed treatment unit. I transferred to adult corrections in the 1980s, working at Palmer Correctional Center as a correctional officer, a shift supervisor, and a facility administrator. I also worked at the Goose Bay Correctional Center out at the Nike site at the end of Goose Bay Road. That facility is no longer in existence. I was promoted to an assistant superintendent at the State Correctional Center Annex, known as the 6th & C Jail, and I also oversaw the 3rd Avenue Jail. Both of those facilities are no longer in existence. I transferred back to Palmer Correctional Center as assistant superintendent. Then in the early 1990s, I worked as an assistant superintendent at Massu Pretrial Facility and a Cook Inlet Pretrial Facility. Cook Inlet Pretrial Facility is now part of the Anchorage Complex. I transferred to Highland Mountain Correctional Center in the mid-1990s and was promoted to the Matsu Pretrial Facility as superintendent. I also worked as a superintendent at Fairbanks Correctional Center and Point McKenzie Farm. I retired with 29-plus years in 2005. In 2008, I was elected to the Matsu Borough School Board as a school board member. I'm on my 5th three-year term on the school board. I have served as vice president and president of that board. I also was appointed to the Alaska Parole Board in 2010, where I served 2 5-year terms for a total of 10 years on the Alaska Parole Board. In 2020, I joined the Nakamoto Group out of Massachusetts. The Nakamoto Group, Inc. is a contracting company that hires correctional professionals to work in ICE detention facilities to ensure compliance with the performance-based national detention standards. The assignment can be in any state that has a detention center that actually houses ICE detainees. I'm on sabbatical with that company, pending the outcome of the parole board confirmation process. I bring to the Alaska Board of Parole 29 years of experience in the Alaska Department of Corrections. 10 years I have served on the Alaska Board of Parole and 2 years working with the Nakamoto Group. I've also served 14 years on the Matanuskas Borough School Board. I served 3 years in the 1990s on the MEA board as a board director. I have the time and the desire to serve on the parole board, and I feel I can give back to the state of Alaska what the state of Alaska has offered myself and my family. I'm eager and willing to serve. Thank you.
Thank you, Ole. You know, it is always heartening to see people with so much experience being willing to offer it in these positions. Do any members have questions for the – oh, also – welcome Senator Hughes to the meeting. She's able to join us. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Ole, for stepping up. And I do apologize, I didn't get to hear your opening remarks, but because I believe I've known you about 32 years, our kids went to grade school, middle school, high school together, and my husband worked with you, overlapped with you a number of years. I feel like I know you. I feel like you're well prepared and well suited for this position, and I just want to thank you for stepping up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Larson, thank you for joining us today. I agree with Senator Hughes. You have a tremendous resume. Unfortunately, I haven't known you 32 years, so maybe just a couple of baseline questions. What the first President Bush called the vision thing. How do you see service on the Board of Parole and your role? What's the goal there?
My role is to work with offenders and to ensure the, of course, the safety of Alaska, as well as being able to hear from victims and to assure that to the best of our ability that we don't release somebody that should not be released, as well as release somebody that has really put in the effort to change, in other words, to get the programs they needed and to actually change your life. You know, most offenders, about 20% of the offenders, in my opinion, should stay in prison. And then about 20% of the offenders that I've worked with over the years have made a mistake in their life and never will come back to jail. So you have about a mid-60% that you can work with that you can hope turn the tide. Because you don't want to release them out into society and have them cause more crime and more turmoil in our society. So I guess my goal is to try my best to not only have a reformation for a person that's coming up for parole, but also to assure the safety of our community.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Larson, thank you. I guess when we look at that middle 60%, two separate questions. One is, how do you see the board best working with and trying to make the best outcomes for those folks? And separate question, what should we be doing differently legislatively to get the best outcome out of those 60%?
Well, we try to work with not only the parole and probation officers, but also the treatment programs that are in the correctional facility, as well as the ones when they get out. So their treatment isn't one that just stops at the door. It's a continuation, and they work themselves also into work and programs, and working with the community. As far as the legislative commitment, I can, if you don't mind me saying, we tried restorative justice at one time, and it did not work in the state. And if we can maintain the same course that we're on, where you have to weigh in not only what the offender is doing and what the victims need, as well as maintain the law enforcement community to ensure safety and to maintain the level of incarceration that's needed. I think right now you have that balance, and if you can continue that, that would be a good thing. Like I said, we tried restorative justice, and it did not work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Other than differing that we actually tried restorative justice, I think we changed the penalties toward restorative justice and then didn't do the other half, which is the restoration piece. But That said, thank you for the answer to the question. I do appreciate it.
I would like to throw in a comment. I do absolutely agree with you. I was on a parole board when restorative justice came through. We pushed too hard. I believe if we were going to do any kind of restorative justice, it should have been over like a 4 or 5 year period. Instead, we put it in a 6 month period and didn't have the programs necessary to carry that restorative justice forward. So I do agree with you on that.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Thank you, Mr. Larson. With no other questions from the committee, at this point, I'm going to open up public testimony on the consideration of Richard Oley Larson being considered for the State Board of Parole. Public testimony is now open. Does anyone in this room want to offer public testimony on Mr. Larson's appointment to the State Board of Parole? And seeing no one here, I look online and I will confirm with Kelsey there's no one online. So at this point, I'll close public testimony on Mr. Oley Larson. And at this point, I will look to Senator Keel. Senator Keel, would you care to make a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the record reflect that in accordance with Alaska Statutes 3950.080, the Senate Judiciary Committee reviewed the appointment of Oley Larson, Richard Oley Larson, to the State Board of Parole and recommends his name be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration.
Hearing no objection, the motion passes, and I will note that signing the reports regarding appointments to boards and commissions in no way reflects individual members' approval or disapproval of the appointees. The nominations are merely forwarded to the full legislature for confirmation or rejection. And with that, we'll do a brief of these to sign the paperwork. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. We'll now bring Senate Bill 124 before the committee, but first I neglected to thank Mr. Larson for making himself available to the committee, and unfortunately he's already disappeared from the Ethernet, but I do want that on the record. Thank you to Mr. Larson for showing up for his appointment hearing. With that, I'll return to Senate Bill 124. We'll bring it back before the Senate Judiciary hearing. This is the Senate Judiciary. This is the first hearing and Senate Judiciary on Senate Bill 124. It is a governor's bill being carried by the Department of Health, and I will ask members to hold their questions until after the presentation. It's a little couple of pages in the presentation. But Ms. Carpenter, would you care to offer a sponsor statement and walk us through the presentation after you put yourself on the record?
Thank you, Chair Holland. For the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health and Social Services currently. The department is carrying this bill in conjunction with the trust, so I will let Mr. Williams introduce himself.
Good afternoon. For the record, Steve Williams, CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Thank you.
And Chair Holland, Heather Carpenter again, we will go ahead and walk through the presentation, which should give a good overview of why the governor introduced this bill and why change is needed.
All right, please continue.
Thank you. This is Steve Williams, CEO for the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing SB 124. Currently, the way we respond to Alaskans in a mental health or a behavioral health crisis is broken. We use our law enforcement and other first responders to try to address the crisis in need, and then our only tools for getting them access to the treatment that they've acquired are our highest levels of service, and often they're the most costly. We don't have anything in the middle to fill out that continuum. SB 124 intends to effectuate a no-wrong-door approach and to address that middle section so that we're not reliant on our limited access at designated evaluation treatment facilities.
And again, this is Heather Carpenter. Like Mr. Williams referenced, The department has what we call designated evaluation and treatment facilities, which I may shorthand as DETs. And these are the facilities designated by the department to serve an individual who is experiencing an acute psychiatric crisis and needs an inpatient level of care. They are the facilities that can serve an individual who needs an involuntary commitment, and they can also serve voluntary patients. Currently, those are only in four communities. There is one here in Juneau at Bartlett Regional Hospital that has 12 beds. There is one in Fairbanks at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital with 20 beds. One in the Mat-Su at Mat-Su Regional Medical Center with 16 beds. And of course, you are very familiar with Anchorage, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. When there is not space at these limited facilities to serve somebody in a psychiatric crisis, they are often having to wait in an emergency room. If you've ever been in an emergency room, you know it is not designed to serve someone in a psychiatric emergency. It can be very overstimulating. Often if somebody is being held there until they can be transported, the ER doctors are going to have to put somebody on a one-to-one observation. They're going to have to take out wires, things from the room so nobody gets injured. So it is not a therapeutic environment. And you're very familiar, I'm sure, with the graphic we have at the bottom of this slide that shows what somebody does in a physical health emergency. And with this model that we talk about, which we refer to as the crisis now model that we're implementing fully through this bill, we're going to change that to address somebody in a behavioral health crisis to have an appropriate response.
For the record, Steve Williams, CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. This slide is designed to illustrate what we mean by no wrong door, and that at this bill allows for the full implementation of the model at the bottom of the screen by creating locations, facilities, where services can be provided to someone in either a voluntary or an involuntary status during a behavioral health crisis. It enhances the options for law enforcement to be able to take someone directly to a location where they know that they will be met by the appropriate levels of professionals to be able to meet the needs of a person in crisis. They will be able to, when fully implemented in communities, they will have options to have a 23-hour crisis stabilization center, a short-term crisis residential center, which could treat someone for up to 7 days, and to have mobile crisis teams be able to respond as opposed to our local law enforcement, the troopers, or emergency medical personnel. This is a very intentionally designed system. It's a system that the department and the trust have looked at in other states, and we've spent the last couple of years working with other states to look at their models, understand them, and then be able to see how that translates to us here in Alaska.
And again, this is Heather Carpenter. Over the last 6 years, the department has been working very intentionally to improve the system of care. And the work was done hand in hand with the trust and our many stakeholders. One key item was in 2016, the legislature passed Senate Bill 74, which was the Comprehensive Medicaid Reform Bill. I want to call out that bill because while it had metrics to improve access, quality, outcomes, and contain cost, one key provision in there was that it told the department they had to apply for what we call a Section 1115 waiver from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to redesign our behavioral health system. An 1115 waiver is just a way to ask the federal government to waive the normal rules, and so we can try, new programs, new systems, and it just has to be cost neutral to the federal government. So by leveraging the 1115 waiver, the goal is to have more treatment options, including crisis stabilization centers and crisis residential centers in all 9 regions of the behavioral health waiver. And we've actually stood up 23 new lines of services in the Medicaid program with that waiver. And additionally, through this, we're trying to set up a system that is intentionally, no wrong door. And while the bulk of individuals who need mental health or behavioral health treatment in Alaska are seen voluntarily, we still need a robust and improved crisis psychiatric response system when somebody is in a crisis and they're unable to ask for that help. And that system must be able to respond quickly so both law enforcement and our first responders can benefit.
Steve Williams with the Alaska Mental Health Trust. This slide illustrates, the top of it illustrates what Ms. Carpenter referenced earlier. We all know that if we have a friend, a loved one, or even see someone in the grocery store collapse in the middle of the store, we know that if it's in a medical emergency, we pick up our phone, we dial 911. We know what that there's going to be someone to answer that call. That person is going to then initiate the appropriate response, and the care will be brought to that person, and the situation will be resolved in the most appropriate manner. At the bottom of this slide, we are designing something that is analogous to the physical health emergency system, the behavioral health crisis emergency system. This system, again, is being operated in other states, Arizona, Georgia, and others. It is supported by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, by NAMI, National NAMI, by the National Action Alliance on Suicide, as well as the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. It's a well-understood model, and it is stood up as a model of excellence. When we started looking at our system and what I would describe as the opportunity of the broken system, the lawsuit that followed in 2018, filed by the Public Defender Agency and the Disability Law Center, we saw this, and the department saw this, as this is the time to change our system. But this was not something that the trust nor the department could do on its own. And this slide just illustrates to you the numbers of different groups that we have been working with together in partnership over the last 2 years to today, and will continue as the model continues to develop and is implemented. It includes state agencies like the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Corrections. It includes beneficiary advocates and nonprofits, the ASHNA, the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, the Alaska Mental Health Board, and other patient advocates. It includes tribal organizations and local governments. There have been over 100 organizations that have been engaged in this effort, representing over 300 people that have participated in helping to guide and intentionally design the system. And we continue to hold work groups with various folks in these communities, specifically, primarily right now, in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the Matsu Valley. We are also doing work down here with Bartlett Hospital, but they are more on point for that effort.
For the record, Heather Carpenter. This slide in this infographic shows the suite of services in the middle that I mentioned that is going to go in between what we have on the far end, which are our community-based services. So those are going to be existing services plus some of those new waiver services. This new suite of services through this bill that will give us new tools. And then on the far end, that inpatient care that I mentioned that we can only have in, an emergency room or DET or API. So it really is a big gap. I do want to highlight that three of those services, mobile crisis team, 23-hour stabilization, and short-term stabilization, are all billable in the Medicaid program through our 1115 waiver.
To go to Steve Williams, CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust, this slide gives you a little bit of more detail of what we mean by crisis stabilization. The first place that someone can be brought to in a crisis for up to 23 hours and 59 minutes. Ideally, this is someone being brought to this location would be members of a mobile crisis team. However, if law enforcement were to be responding to the situation, law enforcement, emergency service, medical services could also bring someone to this location. It would be operating 24 hours, 24/7, 365. And the staffing for this facility and the services provided includes medical professionals, mental health professionals, and also people with lived experience. See, people who have gone through a behavioral health crisis themselves, have engaged in treatment and are on a path of recovery, so that they can meet the individual and provide some assurance that, hey, I've been here too, let me work with you and these folks, and we'll take care of you and try and get your needs met. The next level of care is the short-term crisis residential stabilization center. This is for care for individuals whose acute crisis may not be able to be resolved in that first 23-hour period and could be then stepped up to another level of service for up to 7 days. Again, allowing a little bit more time before we jump to that higher level of care at a DET or API to try and address the behavioral health crisis and meet the person where they're at and get them back into the community with their families as soon as possible. Again, the services provided here are medical professionals, mental health professionals, peers, individuals with lived experience. This next slide is a snapshot of a review of over 10 years worth of data from Georgia. Georgia has this system that we've been describing fully operational. GCAL is the entity that coordinates the services. And when they looked at the data, they pulled a snapshot of 100 calls that were received by a crisis call center. And of the 100 calls received, 90 of them were resolved on the phone. The lowest level of care, the lowest level of intervention, the calls could take anywhere from 5 minutes to 50 minutes. The point being was there was a professional on the other line, end of the line, that was able to address the situation, resolve it, and maybe refer someone to the appropriate levels of care or additional services out in the community. For the 10 calls that weren't resolved on the phone, a mobile crisis team, a mental health professional, and a peer were dispatched to the location where that individual was, in the home, in the community, on a corner of a street. And when the mobile crisis team met that individual in the community, 7 of those 10 calls were resolved by the mobile crisis team. No law enforcement intervention, no emergency medical services intervention. The mobile crisis team was able to address the call in a safe manner, not only for the individual, but for the public as well. For the 3 individuals that couldn't be resolved by that level of intervention, they were taken to the 23-hour crisis stabilization center, where they were met by the medical, mental health, and a peer. And those 2 of those 3, 66% of those folks, were resolved in less than 24 hours. The one person that was left over was taken to the higher level of care where their situation was resolved. So you can see how the system, when you have a full continuum of care, can resolve the situation without the default response of law enforcement or the default response of taking someone to a DET or API.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. I just want to give a little bit of history before I cover some of the key takeaways of the legislation. Like I mentioned, in 2016, the legislature passed Medicaid reform. And after that, as we were implementing the 1115, the trust and the department worked together to really identify the Crisis Now model as that path forward that would further the 1115. We have pulled together communities, stakeholders to look at this firsthand. The trust has sponsored trips down for policymakers and law enforcement to Arizona to have a hands-on walkthrough of those facilities. And additionally, the department in September of 2020 settled our lawsuit with the Disability Law Center and the public defenders that was filed in 2018. That lawsuit was because individuals who had committed no crime were having to wait in correctional facilities due to their psychiatric crisis because there was not room at API or another DET, like I mentioned. As part of that settlement, we had to put forward statutory fixes or other fixes that would allow for an evaluation to occur at other places besides the highest level of care. And that has led to the work that this bill resulted in. And as I mentioned, you know, this does create a no-wrong-door approach that is really key to allowing those evaluations to happen at other facilities. This bill is a win for patients and a win for hospitals and emergency rooms and a win for public safety and law enforcement. And it's a win for patients because the bill is giving less restrictive options for care for a person who's suffering from mental illness. And it's a win for hospitals and ERs because they're going to be able to free up their resources and beds for individuals who are being held on a psychiatric observation because they're going to be able to get into care quicker. And it's a win for law enforcement because the bill provides police officers with broader options on how to handle an individual in a mental health crisis, including mobile crisis teams responding. This bill does not interfere with an officer's authority or ability to make an arrest. That just lies with the officer. And it doesn't change the current statutory authority for who can administer crisis medication. That can only be a physician, a physician's assistant, or an advanced nurse practitioner. And it does not change that current statutory authority for who can order an involuntary commitment. And it does not reduce the individual rights of the adult or the juvenile in crisis, the parent's rights to care for their child, or the existing due process rights of an individual in crisis.
Steve Williams, CEO for the Alaska Mental Health Trust. This slide gives you a graphic of what the current system looks like. And I'd like to focus the committee down in the bottom left-hand corner where you see hospital, ED, jail, secure facility. This is the initial response that we have today. Someone in crisis, you have law enforcement represented by the shield, you have a hospital, you have a jail, and that's where we typically get the initial response to a crisis. Whether that is the level they need or not is really not in question. It's about someone doesn't seem safe, this is where we take them because these are the only tools that we have. Switching to the next slide, staying in that bottom left-hand corner, you'll see a couple of additional tools to the system, building out the continuum of care. You'll see that law enforcement and EMS is still represented there, but you will also see the mobile crisis team and short-term crisis stabilization centers in addition to API in the hospital emergency rooms and jails. The idea here is that it's the mobile crisis response teams accessing the lower levels of care that are needed and are when appropriate, as opposed to just the default response to as to what we have now. It relieves law enforcement from responding to people in a behavioral health crisis and allows them to perform the duties that they are traditionally assigned for, which is protecting public safety and investigating crimes. It allows them to spend more time following up in those criminal matters as opposed to addressing situations of a civil matter of someone in a behavioral health crisis. And it allows, as you see the flow chart or the script graphic, as you move right, you're only moving up into higher levels of care after professionals have assessed the individual and determined that the next level of care is required for that person.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. I just want to cover some of the changes that have happened in this bill in the previous committee of referral. So one key improvement is we actually split the definition of peace officer and add a new definition for health officer. And part of that is we try to refer to the peace officer how it's commonly defined. It had its kind of own unique definition in the involuntary commitment statute. So we were trying to make those a little bit more straightforward. It changed the length of stay from 5 days to up to 7 days at a short-term crisis residential center. And we added provisions that address patient rights, including aligning the 72-hour clock for an ex parte hearing. And that will start when the person is delivered to either a crisis stabilization center or a crisis residential center, whichever one they start in first. And we make sure an appointee is attorney is appointed for the respondent. And one really good addition is the court now has to notify a respondent's guardian, if any. The reason it's the court is because they're the only one who has that full list of who are guardians in the state. And that would include public guardians like you would think of at the Office of Public Advocacy, as well as private guardians. And it allows for the computation of 7 days at a short-term crisis residential center, including the time the respondent was receiving care at a crisis stabilization center, if applicable. There is one section I want to point you to, which is Section 32. This is a pretty comprehensive section that we asked the committee to add after we heard feedback from stakeholders on wanting the bill to look at patient grievances and appeal policies, data collection on reports of harm, restraint, and other improvements. And the department thought it would be best to do this in a really comprehensive way. So we asked for a year timeframe to really bring together a broad group of stakeholders that would include individuals with lived experience, patient advocates, the Disability Law Center, the Ombudsman, the Alaska Mental Health Board, and providers of psychiatric care to take a comprehensive look and come back with recommendations if there are needed statutory changes, to also look at how we can put some of this data on dashboards and be outward facing. And then additionally, we do add in requirements that the notifications in the Alternative to Arrest statutes, which are the first 10 sections of the bill, will also go to the peace officer's employing agency to ensure victim notification will happen if the arresting officer is off duty. That was at the request of the domestic violence advocates that we added that language. And then a couple of other key changes is the bill now is addressing statutes that were found unconstitutional by the Alaska court system to align with court rulings, and that includes Section 26, amending the definition of gravely disabled, and Sections 22 and 23 that clarify standards for the court to administer non-crisis medication. Those you may have seen information or communication that came to previous committees or your committee from Mr. Jim Gottstein with Psychiatric Rights. Those amendments were specifically put forward by him that we were happy to accept. And then the previous committee did add some sections that require further notification of parents, guardians, and other family members when a patient is admitted by a facility. And those are sections 11 and 13. And with that, Chair, we'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. I was looking ahead, and there is like a six-page sectional analysis. We may not get to that today because we still have four invited testimony. Also available to answer questions for the committee is Steve Bookman with the Department of Law, Jennifer Moore Johnson, she's Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, and Leon Morgan, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. I also see we have Commissioner Cockrell in the room. Thanks for joining us. With that, I'll see if there are any questions from the committee. You caught my eye first. I looked at these guys. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that, and thank you both for a good presentation. I wonder if we could just, before we dive into the bill, get maybe a little, sort of clarify a couple of understandings from your slideshow. I was looking at slide 10, which describes sort of your optimal involvement, optimal build-out of the process. Do you have a sense of what these numbers look like now? I mean, you obviously don't mean for us to get the impression that 100 crisis calls mean 100 admissions to a hospital. Do we have a sense of obviously, and there are no 23-hour stabilization facilities, but within the continuum we have now, any sense of what the scope of this is today in Alaska?
And I don't want to hijack the senator's question, but I was even curious about a percentage of the 911 calls that may be diverted down this path as opposed to the typical path.
Steve Williams with the Alaska Mental Health Trust. I think Senator Keel, through the chair to Senator Keel, my initial response is backing up to 2018, when the department and the trust began looking at how could we redesign the system, the trust contracted with a group called RI International, who operates a similar model down in Arizona. They came up to Alaska and assessed specifically Anchorage, Matsu, and Fairbanks, the call volume, the need, and what it would take to build out this system in those communities based on that information. You're absolutely correct. 100 crisis calls does not necessitate admission to a 23-hour crisis stabilization or API in our case. But what this is intending to illustrate is there is a high volume of crisis calls right now that could be resolved on the phone. I don't have that number for you, but it's something that we could look at. Currently, Alaska has the Caroline, which also is our crisis Caroline, is the number that people can call. It's not 988 yet. I don't have the specific numbers for you.
And Heather Carpenter, for the record, I would follow up that we could follow up with some statistics about the experience Fairbanks is having with the mobile crisis teams in particular. Those are operating up there quite successfully and beating, I would say, the national kind of average on response and who they're diverting.
Thanks. All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify a previous comment, is there well that, and then I've got another question to follow. It sounds like you're trying to create a dedicated number for crisis call center similar to 911. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, no, we're going to use our existing numbers. We're not going to create a new number. And the way the model works in other states is if someone calls 911, for example, and the dispatcher on the phone goes through their triage and determines that Steve is really having a behavioral health crisis, they do a warm transfer over to mental health professionals who then respond to my crisis on the phone. And the reverse can happen as well. Someone calls the crisis line in Georgia. The person on the call recognizes this is really a public safety issue. They transfer the call over to 911.
Okay, thank you. A different question. If we could move to slide 7 real quick, just because I'm a visual person. this looks like a really good model. My concern is how things are supposed to operate in communities that don't have all of these pieces. You mentioned the mobile crisis team that's shown up in Fairbanks lately, and that's a great addition to the community. But Fairbanks, from what I understand, is not going to have a 23-hour stabilization center anytime in the near future. Short-term stabilization, I understand some of that happens at FMH as well. But then we're talking about smaller communities as well. I'd kind of like to hear just how we envision this working in some communities that don't have all these pieces, and at what point we start transporting people into other communities. Fairbanks and Anchorage in particular, since we tend to be hubs, at what point do people start to move out of their homes, their home communities, and into other cities?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, through the chair, Senator Myers, that's a really great question. And I think I'll refer you back. One, to what we are trying to do with the 1115 waiver is stand up these new services in each region of the state. So while not, a rural community, all of the villages aren't going to have a 23-hour stabilization or short-term stabilization, perhaps the hub community, like Kotzebue, could add a short-term crisis stabilization in the hub. So if somebody's in crisis instead right now, the only option is to get on a plane and be transported all the way into likely Anchorage, perhaps Fairbanks. They could go closer to home where family can likely have more access to them. They're going to be stabilized, hopefully, by their tribal behavioral health provider, and they're going to be connected to that community outpatient care when they go home. So I think, that's one thing we're looking at. And how we wrote the statutes, we tried to provide flexibility since it is going to be a statewide solution. So if a community only has, short-term crisis stabilization, an individual can be taken there first. They don't have to go to that 23-hour crisis stabilization center first. And like Mr. Williams said, each community, we're working with them to see what makes sense for their community so we don't overbuild these services as well, because there needs to be, the providers need to be able to bill and be, in the black and not be at the whim of, the state having to provide a whole bunch of general fund to subsidize. So I think we'll be looking, and if we can stabilize individuals, whether it's at home, like I said, through services closer to home or the call line, we are going to be reducing the number of people we have to transport in. And that also will save money for the state, because right now, if somebody is in crisis and they're not safe to travel on a commercial airline, the department actually has to pay for a charter plane out to that rural location to then bring them into Anchorage or wherever they're going to care for the DET.
Steve Williams with the Alaska Mental Health Trust. If I could just add quickly to that through the chair, Senator Myers. I think it's important to recognize that what the bill is doing is setting up the ability for this framework to be operational in communities. It's not mandating that communities set this up. So when you talk about demand and population, although Fairbanks may not need all of these, and I'm not saying that that's the case today, but maybe in the future, if Fairbanks grew and the population grew, there would be a structure and a framework that could be set up that says, okay, now we have the demand and our community needs 23-hour and short-term stabilization, and there's a structure that will allow that to be able to happen to meet the needs of the community members.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Thank you. And I'm trying to remember, Mr. Chair, if I mentioned this to you, but I was in the previous Committee of Referral and Health and Social Services, and during that process, there were a number of amendments considered, and there were seven of them that brought up some concepts, and there were either three, four, or five of the members that were interested in them, but they had problems. So I just want to let you know that I, as part of that committee, knowing it was coming here, I was asked to relook at those with those committees. So that'll be some work we'll be doing. I believe it's my count is that there were seven. So I'm not going to bring up those issues now, but I do want to get something on the record because there seems to be so much confusion out there as far as what this bill does. So I'm going to ask a question, kind of a broad question, give you each a chance to weigh in on it. Is there anything in this legislation which, when it comes to involuntary commitments, expands the power, increases the authority, broadens the scope, in other words, the circumstances under which a person might be involuntarily committed, anything that inflates the likeliness or the reasons or the numbers of what we would expect as far as involuntary commitments? In other words, does anything in this legislation make it easier for someone to be taken off the street or someone to show up at their door and say you're being involuntarily committed? And I will be really straight up because there's conversations out there that this bill somehow is expanding the power. So if a person has a political disagreement or a religious difference or something of that sort, that they could be taken into involuntary commitment and being given psychotropic drugs against their will. Is there anything in this bill that is expanding that possibility and the power to do that?
Through the chair, Heather Carpenter, for the record, Senator Hughes, no, there is not. And I would point you to Section 12 of the bill that is current statute that we are amending that requires a peace officer to have probable cause. And I'm going to read direct from the bill. A peace officer who has probable cause to believe that a person is gravely disabled or is suffering from a mental illness and is likely to cause serious harm to self or others of such immediate nature that considerations of safety do not allow initiation of involuntary commitment procedures set out in AS 4730-700 may cause the person to be taken into custody. And the section goes on. Additionally, a mental health professional, when they actually have the person delivered to a facility and they then further say, yes, this person, you know, needs the full evaluation, there's criteria they have to meet to the court, and the court is then reviewing, can this person be held? You know, does it meet criteria? And that individual, the mental health professional, if they, plain speak lie on the application and that the person, you know, doesn't meet criteria based on certain factors, that is a felony and their professional licensure is at stake as well.
And do you have anything to add to that? Or?
Through the chair, no, Senator Hughes.
And, you know, I'm Senator Follow-Up, so I've got to follow up.
Follow up, Senator Hughes?
So what I'm hearing you saying, that what I described initially is that by passing this bill, it's less likely that those kind of things will happen, that this bill actually makes things less restrictive, provides greater patient protections, there's less chance that a person would be picked off the street or a knock at their door to involuntarily commit them for the reasons such as I stated. And so that is what I'm hearing, and I just want to get that on the record because there's a misunderstanding among the public that SB 124 is actually making our statutes worse in that regard. And from what I'm reviewing and studying and hearing, I think it's an improvement. And if we do not pass this bill, the intent of what we've discussed in the last committee and what we're beginning to discuss here won't carry through with the statute. So I think it's more important than ever that this bill pass. And I, you know, if members of the public have questions about this, I think they should contact the members on this committee, Mr. Chair, because this bill is actually an improvement over existing statutes.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I'll just speak to Section 12. And I understood when you were, Ms. Carpenter, when you were reading, you left portions out because to make it read. But so we do include health officer, mental health professional, or physician assistants licensed by the state medical board to practice in the state. And some may see that as an expansion of persons who can make these decisions. But I also understand that prior to that, the only person that was empowered to make that decision was a police officer, a peace officer. And I do wonder if a peace officer is the best person to make those decisions. I think it's an improvement to include the other items. My question about a health officer, is that typically, we believe, going to be a member of the mobile crisis team? Because when you say health officer, it's not going to be anyone working in the various centers, right? Who's probably going to be part of the mobile crisis team?
Chair Holland, that is correct. And like I mentioned in the overview, we're changing the definition of peace officer to be more in line with where it is in other statutes. So now it's going to have the meaning in Section 27 given in AS 0110.060A. And if you see there's a lot of terms that are deleted in Section 27 that show up in the new health officer term. So we were trying to come up with a creative fix to make a new term that made sense. But in addition to that, we do add individuals for the mobile crisis teams, because you're exactly correct. So we add an emergency medical technician, a paramedic, or a firefighter are the new ones. And that is with the mobile crisis team in particular. And I'll also point out, because that Section 12 had some confusion, so the other terms that are being deleted there in that section are all in the definition of a mental health professional. So we were trying to just make the statute make more sense. And the reason a physician assistant is called out is because they are not in the definition of a mental health professional. So we had to call them out specifically.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. a question maybe on the flip side of the exact same coin, because the delicate work we do to protect public safety, while, as Senator Hughes and the chair said, absolutely protecting people's rights to the greatest extent we can, does have that other element. I saw, I was looking at your slide number 14, and I just want to make sure that as we looked at the text of the bill, we have a clear understanding. I want to make sure I'm understanding the flow of these holds when someone really is in crisis. And I guess where I'm getting to is if you have someone who is I'm trying to figure out how to word this, Mr. Chairman. Can you skip any of these hold steps when it's really that bad? So you have a patient, you have an Alaskan who is had a real dissociation. They've had a break with reality. There is violence. There is. Do they have to go to the 23-hour first? Can somebody start them with the court order for the much more serious treatment? Do we have enough tools while protecting public safety to do the longer holds, the more restrictive environments that we have today?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes. And that is a great question. And actually, if you look how the bill is laid out, you know, Section 14 are the new sections that stand up the statutory requirements for using crisis stabilization centers or crisis residential centers. And then Section 15 is our current hospitalization track. And we're not taking away any of those tools. So if you know, the situation is really critical and that it's not appropriate to go to those first two centers first, absolutely, you can go to the court right away for that hospital track. At the same time, it may make more, you know, instead of having somebody wait in an emergency room for that transfer, they may use a 23-hour crisis stabilization center because it's a more appropriate immediate resource. But that mental health professional would, again, apply and maybe say, you know, this isn't the right place. So it's offering better, you know, care right away while still allowing the professionals, the mental health professionals and the doctors to make the best decisions for the patients and where they need to be served.
Thank you, Senator Keel. I'm sure these are not the end of the questions from the committee. This is a 16-page bill. Some parts are a little complex. A 6-page sectional analysis. Some parts kind of complex. 4-page explanation of changes. Some parts be kind of complex. But we do have some invited testimony. And if we could, at this point, we'll turn to some of the invited testimony. And I see you have Leon Morgan, the Deputy Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. And
Chair Holland, the commissioner himself is
going to. Ah, well, hey, then we have someone in person. We have Commissioner Cockrell himself. I appreciate you joining us today in person. Please make yourself comfortable at the presenter's table. And we do have 30 minutes or so left for invited testimony. We do have 4 members to speak. I will be prepared to go a little bit beyond the top of the hour if necessary to complete this. But Commissioner Cockrell, thank you for joining us. And put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
You're welcome. Senator Hallman, to the chair, James Cockrell, commissioner of the Lax Department of Public Safety. It's certainly, I feel honored to be asked by Hess to testify on this bill. I feel it's a very important improvement in our mental health responses. Personally and professionally, I've had to deal with, or our family has had to deal with a person that went through a mental health crisis, ended up getting arrested and spending 81 days in one of our prisons and in and out of emergency rooms with all the calls going directly to the local police department to affect to deal with the crisis, which, you know, certainly didn't help this person, and it put this person in our system at a great expense, and it didn't address the problems. And when you look at how this state, probably since statehood, has addressed mental health issues, it's unacceptable. They expect the local law enforcement or your Alaska State Troopers to respond to them and deal with them in a professional way. Where even with the training we have, we don't have the tools. We're not the experts to do it. Many times, situations could be handled much different if we had a system like they're proposing right now. This is not a police response. Probably over 75% of them are not police responses. And we need to get the local law enforcement and your Alaska State Troopers out of it. Give them the tools necessary when we do have to address it. But I'll just kind of leave it at that. I think this is very important. I wouldn't be here if I didn't think it was important. I didn't even realize it was Governor Bill until the first time I testified to it. But this is personally important to me. It's important to our department, and the Alaska State Troopers Department of Public Safety certainly support this bill.
All right. I appreciate the to the point and brevity of your comments. We do have a little bit of time. I'll see if the Senator Hughes.
Can you speak to how it works right now, and what kind of, do you have examples of what your officers have encountered because we don't have something like this set up?
Well, I'll take one example from your area this winter. We had an individual that was on the Kinnick River Bridge, middle of the winter time, traffic on the highway, was going through a mental health crisis and was going to jump off the bridge. Troopers arrived and literally caught the guy as he was jumping off the bridge to save his life. We had a similar situation at Canyon Creek right before the cold cutoff, where an off-duty trooper basically did the same thing. An individual decided he wanted to jump off the bridge in a mental health crisis, and we responded and was able to talk that person down and get additional resources. I will say, because I know that I addressed this in the House Finance Committee, because everybody wanted to know about the situation Wausau at the school. Realistically, a trooper or Wausau police officer should not have been called to that. That should have been handled under this current system with a mental health professional, not an Alaska State Trooper or Wausau police officer. there's certainly not the end result that we would like to see. I will say that I talked to that trooper a few days afterwards. I know that he's a kind, compassionate trooper, certainly not the directions he wanted to go, but felt at that time with the tools necessary after spending more than a half hour at the school that that was his only option to ensure nobody got hurt. And realistically, nobody got hurt. And, you know, I support the actions of the troopers based on this, the totality of the circumstances. And it certainly has been looked at very closely by our department, by the Division of the Alaska State Troopers. And, you know, and I'll stand by supporting the trooper based on my knowledge of the case and his actions and the fact that nobody got hurt.
Senator Hughes.
So you gave us three examples of the kind of conditions, and that third, I'm assuming, was the autistic little boy. But three kind of encounters. But what happened then as far as the officers when they got to the bridge? Were they taking these people to the emergency department? Were they taking them? There was no room. They had to take them to jail. I've heard of a story I believe it was at Mattsu Regional Medical Center. And I'm not sure if the person was a minor or over 18, where they were taken to the emergency department and then ended up, and it was during COVID when people couldn't get in and ended up being held for 5 days without, you know, family being able to see the person, just not the appropriate, they weren't getting the appropriate care. So can you, I think I heard of a story one time when an officer had to drive around all day with a person in a mental health episode because there was no place to take them. So I'd like to know how it is once you encounter these people and the kind of situations it's putting your officer in and how much time it is taking for them and it's not helping the person who they've picked up.
Sure. We've had certainly examples where we've had to take a mental health person into custody late in the evenings and trying to find a place to place that person. We've had troopers drive all the way to API, turn around, come back out to your case into the valley. I know that Mattsu has increased your bed space from 2 to like 16, which is a huge help for the department. But we've, you know, you go down to the Kenai Peninsula, they just have the Kenai, the hospital there. It's got 2 beds. They're really not set up for it. So what happens is we take them in. If we can find a place to take them, we'll drop them off. Whether we stay there or not, it depends on the circumstances. But then that person is in the ER for up to 2 hours for a psych evaluation. My experience is usually less than 2 hours because they want them out as fast as possible too because they're busy and they don't want to deal with it. And again, somebody having mental health issues, do they deserve to be handcuffed and put in the back of our patrol cars? I think that's the big question, and that's what we do. We don't put anybody in our cars without handcuffing them, even people that are dealing with mental health issues, because you just, again, it helps protect that person from getting hurt in the back of the patrol car. Plus, we need to make sure that we have control of the person when we take them out. But realistically, if you had a loved one that was having a mental health issue, would you want an Alaska State Trooper or your local Wasilla Palmer Police Department in Fairbanks take them to the hospital in cuffs and, you know, walk them to the ER? I've been on the department off and on since 1983, and I still remember the first Title 47 that I transported from Kenai as a young trooper 1 year on to take a taxi to API to drop this person off. She was like 18 years old, threatened to commit suicide, and just frightened to death. And that stuck with me for, what, almost 40 years. You just remember that kind of stuff. Because, again, we got to do better. And we have an opportunity to do better. I mean, we all take these jobs. I take one. You know, I want to make a difference in this state. You guys have gotten elected. You got vetted by the people that voted for you, a higher level than I am. We want to make a difference, and I know you do, and this is one way to do it. This thing will last forever, and we'll just improve. We should be the leader in how we handle mental health, not the lowest state in the country. And that's where I feel we're at.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Cockrell. At this point, thanks for offering your testimony. And so we're going to get back on schedule to invite a testimony. Mark Regan, Legal Director of Disability Law Center. I see you joined us with Teams. If you can hear me, please unmute yourself. And there you are. All right. So please state your name, your affiliation, and your location, and begin your invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Regan. I'm the legal director of the Disability Law Center, and I'm in my office in Anchorage. I want to make two quick points. One is why Disability Law Center sued and what our lawsuit has to do with the Crisis Now bill now pending before you. But maybe the more important thing is I want to talk about how the rights of people in crisis are protected under this bill. And maybe I should address that first. In further response to Senator Hughes's question about the standards and methods through which people in crisis are picked up and involuntarily brought somewhere else to get short-term treatment or to be evaluated for civil commitment. The standard that the bill before you uses is the same standard that is in existing law. Is there probable cause that the person is likely to harm himself or herself or others, or is the person gravely disabled? And that's the rule that a police officer or anybody else in the system needs to follow in deciding whether to bring somebody in. That's not changed in the bill. So there is no intensification or worsening of the conditions in which you can be brought into confinement. It's the same standard. And that's been in the bill throughout. The other ways in which people's rights are protected in the bill is the bill clearly provides that if you're at a crisis residential center or a crisis stabilization center and the person in charge wishes to hold you for a longer period, that the person in charge goes to the magistrate or the judge and asks for an ex parte, that means other people not present, order. And part of the order will be appointing the public defender agency or other attorney to represent you. So right at the start of the process, as is true under existing law, you would get an attorney to represent you. You will also have the opportunity to have a hearing within the 72-hour period if the crisis residential center thinks your problem will be resolved or stabilized within 7 days total. You have the opportunity to put the state to its test and get a hearing at which you'll have the opportunity to present your case on why it is that you should be out. Those are the important improvements, I think, that are in the bill. And the bill poses no greater risk for people who want their rights protected and for people who don't want to be brought into the system involuntarily that they have now under the civil commitment system for evaluation. That's the basic point. I should also explain that a reason we are here today is that back in 2018, the overstressed evaluation system at particularly API collapsed. And it was at that point that API put out word that people would have to be held in jail waiting for their civil commitment evaluation or held in hospital emergency rooms waiting for their civil commitment evaluation. API couldn't do the things it had been trying to do before. That's what led to our lawsuit. And it is fortunate that at the same time all this was breaking down, the trust and the state were working on putting together a Crisis Now proposal where people would have more alternatives where they could go and where they would get something close to a therapeutic treatment as opposed to being stuck in a hospital emergency room or worse in a jail. That's what led both to our lawsuit and that led to the settlement of our lawsuit, where we did agree to the idea that there would be a Crisis Now system that would partly replace and certainly make easier to deal with the system that was having such trouble with respect to API. So that's why we sued. That's why we settled. And we hope that the bills before the bill before you will lead to an improvement for people who are in crisis and people who need help. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Regan. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for making yourself available today. Next up will be Dr. Helen Adams with the Alaska Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I believe she's joining us by phone. Dr. Adams, if you can hear me, please go ahead and begin. State your name, your affiliation, your location, and begin your presentation. If we can't hear you, you'll know. We'll start asking for you.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me today. My name is Dr. Helen Adams. I'm an emergency physician. I live in Anchorage. I serve on the board of the Alaska Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I also serve on the board of API. I'm speaking to you from Anchorage. I have had the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill now since my third time, and I find it really interesting how every group of people I speak to bring up different issues. And I'd like to just highlight why I think this bill will be transformative for Alaskans. I think one of the really important things I'd like to speak to is just my personal experience being someone who puts people on mental health holds, as someone who signs that paperwork and makes the determination of whether or not someone is an immediate threat to themselves, others, or gravely disabled. I agree with earlier testimony that this bill is not expanding the provisions under which we take that action. Instead, what it's doing is allowing other healthcare providers who are adequately trained to do so. And currently, when I use the paperwork that we use to do this, there's three boxes: peace officer, police officer, or physician, as the three people who have the role to be able to sign the paperwork. And I think that this bill broadening the number of people who are on that list to include physician assistants, I don't want to misquote the bill, and I think the mental health providers at the Crisis Stabilization Center is really valuable to Alaskans, specifically because these are people who are more specifically trained on how to decide when this provision should be enacted. And the opportunities to create a hold are not changing. It's just changing the people who decide to create the hold. And I think that that is protective because, and I mean this in no disrespect towards our police officers, but they are making decisions about holds in incredibly stressful positions, like on a bridge with wind and snow and a crisis person. That's a really clear opportunity to make a very fast, inappropriate decision to put them on a hold. But sometimes things are more nuanced. They are in a home where there's yelling, there's multiple angry people. It's not clear which people are in crisis or maybe all of them. Sometimes people come in on hold, and maybe they were on hold because they had inappropriate behavior simply because a police officer was present, because the presence of a police officer is triggering a trauma response. And when we get those patients alone with a mental health clinician who's trained to de-escalate and speak to them on their level, what we find is that oftentimes those holds that they initially come in with from the community can be de-escalated, and we can get those patients home with outpatient resources. So in that respect, I think that those changes are important and valuable, and I would love to answer questions about my experiences putting people on hold. I think another way that I like to talk about this bill is just how it's transformative for everyone. Currently in our ER today, this morning, I worked last night till 2 a.m., we have 18 people being held in emergency department beds in our department waiting placement. We only have 50 beds in our department, and 18 of them are being occupied by people who need mental health placement. Some of those people are there involuntarily. Some of them are there voluntarily. Meanwhile, last night, I think at one point, we had 19 people sitting in the lobby with all sorts of medical complaints, children, adults, teenagers, tons of medical complaints who are waiting 2 and 3 and 4 hours to be seen when 18 beds are being held by mental health patients. We have a crisis of space. We have a mental health crisis, and we need to come up with solutions. This open door approach will be, hopefully, a transformative thing for our community. The ability to de-escalate on the phone, to de-escalate with a mobile crisis unit, then to take people who are appropriate to 24-hour stabilization centers, maybe they go on to 7 days, maybe they go on to longer, but getting more doors, not just, I want to see all the doors be opened for Alaskans. And I only see this program as an improvement. And so I want to kind of pause and see if anyone has any questions about why I have that perspective or how I can help answer questions about this bill.
Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Hughes.
I may be putting you a bit on the spot, but hearing about the number of people in the beds and the number of people in the waiting room, you may not be comfortable to say, but I am kind of concluding that actually without something like this, we could be a person's medical condition could be worsening out in the waiting room. And so we're actually harming people, people that, non-mental health patients, because we don't have something like that. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I would love to speak to you guys about this even more. But when we are harming mental health, like we're harming people with mental health disorders by holding them in the ER for days waiting for beds. Proper mental health treatment involves these kind of like soothing, restorative clinical environments where you have group therapy and you have therapeutic activities, you have occupational therapists, you have mental health therapists. The ER is devoid of those resources. When I say someone is waiting in our ER to be placed in a mental health hospital, they're waiting in a room in uncomfortable clothing that is not their own. The room has been stripped of all wires and tools with which they could use to harm themselves, and there is a stranger sitting on a stool outside a glass door watching every move they make. There's zero privacy. There's zero access to natural light. There's zero access to group therapy. They get a physician check-in once a day and a mental health clinician check-in once a day. These people are basically in solitary confinement awaiting placement. That is harmful and should be used as a short-term solution to keep people literally safe from their own self-harming attempts until they can be placed in the proper clinical environment. Meanwhile, you're right. Your family member might be sitting in the lobby with an appendicitis that could rupture because they can't get a bed on which to be examined or on which to get a CT scan for their appendicitis. Another issue that was brought up earlier is the transportation of people from more rural communities looking for mental health treatment. I myself know of many situations that occur frequently, whatever this post-pandemic world we're living in, where patients are sitting in APD and trooper vehicles in our parking lot for hours. And these are patients who simply need help. They did no criminal activity. And I have personally gone out to vehicles in our like ambulance bay to do a medical examination on someone who's been in cuffs or in extreme cases, like even kind of hogtied for hours. And I do kind of like a circulation check on their extremities because we're waiting to get them into a bed where they can be let out of restraint. We have such strict policies on restraints when patients are actually under the care of our hospital. Those patients, it is mandated, must be checked within an hour of being placed in restraints by me, the physician. Where's the physician checking on these patients in handcuffs for hours in the back of APD cars? No offense to APD, this is not their fault. They have to be safe from these people too. But I'm just saying, it's hard. It's really scary. It's hard. It's not appropriate. It's wrong. And this bill is an opportunity to have a transformation in our system.
All right. If you could make a quick question, Senator, too. We do have one more speaker, and we're running up about 5 minutes on the end of the to the end of the meeting.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chairman. We don't always get an ER doc in judiciary, but thank you, Doctor, for being here. I appreciate. All of your comments, I desperately wish they were a surprise, but they match what I've heard from providers in my own community and from law enforcement. Can you talk to us just a little bit about emergency room physicians and your ability to assess whether somebody needs to go to the 24-hour facility, whether somebody needs to go to the 7-day facility, whether you need to send them down the track toward the longer-term commitment? How confident are you in the resources an emergency department has to look at that?
I think as this rolls out, we're going to see a lot of different treatment levels be created. I think that not all of these facilities that get created will be the same. Some of them are going to be better equipped for the more high acuity patients than others, and they are going to have to each, as different institutions, create their own kind of triage process for what their staff can handle. And I'm sure those decisions will be made on a case-by-case basis based off their staff, security, et cetera. I think that where I don't see a lot of changes is the acutely violent, and I mean the truly violent, dangerous, large adult patient will probably still be cared for at hospitals, at large hospitals where we have a lot of security staff, a lot of staff, and can handle those things with large doses of effectively sedatives. I also think, and there should be no confusion, anyone who's harmed themselves by an ingestion or who is so acutely intoxicated on drugs that they're a threat to society, those people will also, like, for example, overdoses, whether accidental or intentional, those people are also always going to be managed at our highest acuity facilities like MatSU, ER, Providence ER, Regional ER, et cetera, where we have the capabilities to care for both our medical and psychiatric needs. I think that I'm very curious to see if we see just incredible improvements in patient behaviors and interactions with staff when we start removing kind of like the police presence from our mental health process. I think we're going to see safer patient interactions. I think we're going to see patients de-escalate way faster, because when you are meeting them on their level with a peer and with a mental health professional, you get a completely different experience. I think patients will be safer because they will have fewer outbursts behaviorally. I think staff will be safer. I think APD will be safer. I think that it can only improve. And I think we'll be surprised that people who have been historically violent will probably do really well in these peer appropriate studies and may be able to utilize the 24-hour and 7-day resources better than we think they would. But we have to give them a chance. And we have to give our community a chance to do better. And we're good at triaging people. And I think that these new institutions will also be, and they're going to know when something is above what they can handle, and they're going to send it to us. And vice versa, we're going to know when it's safe. And I think if we don't try, we'll never know. Is that helpful?
Ms. Chairman, yes, thank you. I think part of the what you addressed is that fewer folks who meet those very, very threatening criteria you described are going to come into the emergency room doors. And that I think, may have been what I was missing when I asked the question. Thank you. All right.
Fewer of those aggressive people will be created. Like, I think just fewer aggressive interactions will happen in general when we start approaching people with peers at their level, in their homes, on the street.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Adams. Now I'm going to move to Ann Ringstad with the National Alliance on Mental Health Alaska, Executive Director of NAMI Alaska. And Ms. Ringstad, if you can hear me, please state your name, your affiliation, and your location. I apologize that we're running up on the top of the hour, but we will not end this at the top of the hour. I don't want you to feel rushed in your testimony. But thank you for hanging on this long. But please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my testimony is about 4 minutes, so I'll try to get through it in that length of time. Good afternoon, Senator Holland and member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Ann Ringstad, Executive Director for NAMI Alaska, and I'm currently in Anchorage. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to provide testimony in support of SB 124 regarding crisis residential centers and crisis stabilization centers. As background, NAMI Alaska is part of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the nation's largest grassroots mental health organization dedicated to building better lives for the millions of Americans affected by mental illness. Mental illness affects more than 1.5 adults, that's 5 million people in the United States. In Alaska, that translates to over 108,000 individuals, more than 3 times the population of Juneau. We know firsthand how those with mental health challenges can struggle with an inadequate system of care, especially those who are experiencing a behavioral health crisis. I'm providing testimony for Dr. Shirley Holloway, the president of NAMI National and vice president of NAMI Alaska, because I think it demonstrates the importance of this legislation. In her previous testimony on House Bill 172 to the House Finance Committee a few weeks back, Dr. Holloway shared the story of her daughter Kathleen's long journey with mental illness and why she became involved with NAMI. Kathleen's last contact with her mother was when she called her during a mental health crisis. She Shirley was out of state at the time, and she immediately sprung into action, calling her physicians, therapists, neurologists, anyone she could think of, and other supports, all who responded that they maybe could see her in 2 weeks, or maybe just take her to the ER and they can deal with it. 4 hours into her calls for help, as Shirley was boarding a plane to Anchorage to get to Kathleen, she called Anchorage police and asked for their assistance. By the time they located her, it was too late. I agree with the ER physician that just testified. I can personally vouch that emergency rooms are not the appropriate holding rooms to assist those individuals who need professional evaluation and treatment for behavioral health issues in an expedient fashion. ERs deal with medical emergencies, not behavioral health emergencies. I also agree with Steve Williams' assessment of the current system as broken. If there was a crisis response system in place 10 years ago, Shirley's story might have had a different outcome. Subacute mental health facilities, including crisis residential centers and crisis stabilization centers, are a proven care alternative, offering prompt support and evaluation to assist with the real issues of why the individual was brought there in the first place, evaluating what resources they may require, and taking steps to help resolve their mental health challenges. This no-wrong-door approach to providing care to a person in a psychiatric crisis will facilitate a faster and more appropriate response to a behavioral health crisis. We need to reimagine our crisis response system to one that offers help, not handcuffs. This legislation will ensure people get appropriate care swiftly, keep them out of jails and emergency rooms, and minimize the impact on first responders. We support the work of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and the collaborative efforts of multiple stakeholders, including emergency service responders, hospitals and healthcare providers, Department of Health and Social Services, public safety, corrections and law, and trust beneficiaries throughout the state who are part of making the Crisis Now initiative work in their communities. There is still much work to be done, and this legislation is an important step in the continuum of care for mental health. I will also add that we support the requirements to provide a report to the legislature at the one-year mark of passage of this legislation to assess the outcomes of this legislation and provide recommendations to strengthen and improve patient outcomes with the identification of recommended changes to state statutes, regulations, and requirements. We look forward to a future where this type of behavioral health system is in place throughout Alaska. We strongly support Senate Bill 124 and ask you to support this important legislation to provide a critical piece to the Crisis Now continuum of care. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to testify.
All right. Ann Ringstad, thank you for providing your testimony. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? All right. And once again, thanks to all the invited testimony for hanging on as long as they were. I'm not prepared to set an amendment deadline yet for this. I anticipate it's going to be possibly Wednesday of next week. I think this is going to be kind of a complicated bill. We may have a bit more discussion to go on with it, but I understand we're at the end of the session pretty much, and I'll be talking to the committee members about seeing if there's an opportunity maybe to schedule an extra meeting or two somewhere in the middle to kind of move some of this and some of the other issues that are coming in front of us towards the end of the session. But with that, with no other business before the committee, our next planned meeting is April 29th at 1:30 p.m. And with that, we are adjourned at 3:05 p.m.